The following is chapter 3 in Walter Youngquist's book, Geodestinies. Title of the chapter, Minerals and War, and Economic and Political Warfare. As the chapter title implies, minerals have been involved in various kinds of warfare in several ways. Minerals have been the cause of armed conflict. Nations that wanted them took them, or tried to take them, by conquest. Minerals were used by nations in economic warfare, by withholding access to minerals, or by cutting off the supply of minerals as an embargo to accomplish some political end. Economic warfare can be waged by forming a cartel and fixing the price of oil, as the Organization for Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, has done in the past. The Arab oil embargo of 1973 was done for political purposes, to influence the United States' position on Israel. As demands for Earth's resources, especially oil, have risen markedly, another version of economic warfare has developed. It might be called simply open market competition, but the playing field is somewhat uneven. Some countries use government subsidies or low-cost loans to secure resources. China has companies that benefit from such loans. Behind-the-scenes political maneuvering, along with bribes to key political figures, can also be important economic factors in securing resources. As pressures rise to acquire resources to support growing populations, and with increasing industrialization by some countries, notably China and India, these strategies are increasing. Minerals used in warfare. For early humans, hand-to-hand combat with perhaps a few minerals in the form of rocks were the weapons of warfare. Then the stone axe, knife, and spear were invented, followed by improved spears, knives, and the longer knives called swords, made of metal. Arrows had a similar history. Arrows were first tipped with stone materials, such as flint and obsidian, and later were metal-tipped. The first knife was stone, but when native copper was discovered and hammered into knives, as was done in several places in the world, the metal age of warfare began. Metals in war have been important ever since. Early use of oil in warfare. Oil in its various forms has long played a key role in warfare. In modern times, its role has been to fuel warplanes, ships, tanks, and a great variety of motorized transport vehicles of warfare. But oil had a very early history in war. About the year 672 AD, the Byzantine navy was besieged by the Muslims. But a native of Syria named Kalinikos defected to the Byzantines and brought with him the formula for making a petroleum mixture that would burn even on water. Armed with this information, the Emperor Constantine IV built a siphon-like structure on the bow of some of his ships so that the flaming mixture could be squirted onto enemy vessels and on the water near them. During the seventh year of the siege, this weapon was used with remarkable success against the Muslim navy in what was called the Battle of Kastakos. The entire fleet, manned chiefly by Syrians and Egyptians, was destroyed. One historian estimated the losses at 30,000 men. A modern modification of this use of oil in warfare is the form of a flamethrower was extensively used in World War II. Particularly on some of the rocky and cavernous islands of the South Pacific. Oil in the form of naphtha continued to be important in Middle East conflicts. In 1167, the Christian king of Jerusalem, Amalric I, decided to annex Egypt. He moved against Cairo with his army. Unable to successfully resist, the city commander resolved to reduce Cairo to rubble. This he did with the aid of thousands of naphtha pots, some of which were apparently modified to become primitive explosive grenades containing a kerosene jelly, nitrates, and sulfur. An Egyptian historian, Al-Makritzi, reported that the city commander sent 20,000 naphtha pots and 10,000 lighting bombs and distributed them throughout the city. Flames and smoke engulfed the city and rose to the sky in a terrifying scene of a blaze raging for 54 days. Alexander the Great, in his military ventures in the Middle East, was given a warmer reception than he anticipated when the natives of one area poured naphtha on a downward slope toward Alexander's tent and then set it on fire. Uranium, the ultimate weapon. World War II in the Pacific was triggered over oil supplies. World War II in Europe was over land and the resources the land contained. Hitler especially wanted the huge metal and petroleum resources of the Soviet Union. But it was a metal that, at the beginning of World War II, was not much more than a laboratory curiosity that ultimately ended the war and forever changed the world. The metal is uranium. Before World War II, it did not have much of a market and, in fact, was regarded as an undesirable impurity in some ores. Silver ores in the Coeur d'Alene mining district of northern Idaho, especially those from the Sunshine Mine, contained some uranium, and this ore was penalized at the smelter. Some of the rock from the mine, which contained uranium, was used simply to make and maintain part of the road to the mine. But possession of uranium allowed the U.S. to dramatically end World War II by dropping two atomic bombs on Japan. Japan's demand for oil started the Pacific War, and uranium ended it. This single mineral moved warfare a quantum leap forward in just 6 years. The war started with the use of horse-drawn cannon and mounted cavalry in Poland and ended in a nuclear flash over Japan. Salt, Rome, and Carthage. Salt has been used as a final act of warfare. After a long series of the Punic Wars with Carthage from 264 BC to 146 BC, Rome finally prevailed. It utterly destroyed Carthage, plowed the city, the site of the city and its fields, and sowed salt on the fields to destroy their fertility. Minerals used to pay for war. Silver and war. Silver was discovered in many areas of the ancient world, but in one particular area, it played an important role affecting the course of Western civilization. In the limestone hills near the town of Larium, and also near the village of Plotka, about 30 miles northeast of Athens, large deposits of silver were discovered. For many years, Athens and Greek culture flourished in part because of the wealth taken from these mines. Each citizen of Athens was given an annual share of this treasure, recovered at great effort and loss of life by thousands of slaves working in the mines. But Persians threatened the wealth and culture enjoyed by the Greeks. They first moved against Greece in the year 492 BC under Mardonius, who had a substantial fleet of many men. The Persian fleet was largely wrecked by a storm as it approached southern Greece and the survivors returned home. But the threat did not disappear. It only grew as the Persians reassembled and attacked Attica in 490 BC with a fleet of 600 ships. After invading southern Greece, the Persians landed on the beach at the plain of Marathon, only a few miles from Athens. Here, anywhere from 20,000 to 100,000 Persians, estimates vary widely, were met by only 9,000 Athenians and 1,000 Plataeans. But the Greeks, with great courage, staged a mass running attack against the Persians, which demoralized them, and they fled in confusion. Reportedly, some 6,400 Persians were killed, whereas the Greeks lost only 192 soldiers. Even after this defeat, the Persian menace did not vanish. The Persians planned yet another invasion, and this time silver played a crucial role. Themistocles, a perceptive and foresighted Greek, had argued persistently for a substantial navy. To accomplish this, he suggested that the Athenians forego their annual dividend from the great silver mines near Athens, and that the money be used to build ships. At the time, the Greeks had only about 70 ships. The Athenians heeded Themistocles, and ultimately 130 more ships were built, paid for by the silver. The Persians invaded again with a great fleet and several hundred thousand men. After a series of skirmishes, the Persians overran and sacked Athens. It now remained for the Persian fleet to destroy the Greek navy, which consisted of about 300 ships, 200 of them Athenian. The 130 ships built with the silver revenues from the Larkin-Platka area were the newest and best ships designed for speed and maneuverability. In late September 480 BC, the Persian commander Xerxes took a seat on the prominence overlooking the Bay of Salamis, just west of Piraeus, the port of to Athens. Here he confidently prepared to witness the destruction of the Greek navy. The ships of the Greeks were smaller and outnumbered about 3-1 by the Persian vessels. But the Greek ships were fast and easy to maneuver, and they were fitted with battering rams. They quickly moved through the Persian fleet, shearing off their oars, ramming them, and leaving them dead in the water, waiting to be further rammed and sunk. The Persian fleet was destroyed. The Battle of Salamis marked the high water mark for the Persians in Greece, and eventually the Greeks freed themselves from the Persians. Greece continued to flourish and provide the foundation of Western civilization in the form of its democratic ideals and the corresponding liberties in individual freedom and in economics. Without the silver mines to build the ships with which the Greeks destroyed the Persian fleet, the course of Western civilization would have been markedly different. Minerals and Sweden's military ventures. The exploitation of silver, copper, and iron deposits in Sweden about 1600 was a major factor in the increase in the wealth of Sweden. Money derived from Sweden's minerals helped to finance the Thirty Years' War and the invasion of Germany in 1630 by the Swedish king Gustav Adolphus. In the end, the Habsburg Empire was destroyed, and Germany was divided into more than 300 independent states, principalities, and free towns. Oil financing the Iraq-Iran War. Oil was a major factor in the hostilities in the 1980s between Iran and Iraq. In this instance, it was the ability to market the oil and thus obtain free exchange with which to buy the weapons of war, which made oil so important. Iraq, greatly outnumbered in terms of fighting men and equipment, initially had a difficult time against larger and more powerful Iran. The materials of war had to be purchased by both sides with their oil resources. Iran had the Karg oil terminal on the Persian Gulf and also largely controlled access to the Gulf at the Strait of Hormuz, through which almost all of Iraq's export oil had to travel. This put Iraq at a great initial disadvantage in selling oil abroad to pay for the war. Iraq survived this early crisis because of massive aid from friendly Arab nations who used their own oil to buy war materials for Iraq. And then he has in parentheses, Iraq is both Muslim and Arab. Iran is Muslim, but not Arab. With help chiefly from Saudi Arabia, Iraq eventually built a pipeline to the Mediterranean, followed shortly by a second line. Then a pipeline was built from Iraq to the Saudi Arabian port of Yanbu on the Red Sea, which Iran could not control. By these means, Iraq was able to increase production from virtually nothing to more than 1.5 million barrels a day to buy war materials. This turned the tide in the war. Mineral resources often affect the destiny of nations through the procurement of much-needed foreign exchange and the materials it buys. In this case, it literally meant the survival of Iraq. Later, when Iraq became stronger, it attacked Iran's Karg oil terminal, rendering it at least partially useless as an oil outlet. Iran had no pipeline alternative to markets, as did Iraq. As a result, Iran's ability to sell oil abroad was substantially reduced. The initial advantage which Iran had over Iraq was lost, and the war became a stalemate. Furthermore, popular support for the war fell within Iran because, without substantial oil revenues, Iran could no longer subsidize its domestic economy as it had, as much as it had in the past. Large imports of foodstuffs, chiefly wheat and rice, had been distributed at reduced prices to the general population. Iran's inability to market oil was the swing factor in this conflict. The equipment of war. From ancient times to the present, various metals, but especially iron, copper, tin to make bronze, and aluminum, have been used to make the equipment of war. Chariots, swords, spears, guns, bullets and shells, tanks, trucks, ships, planes, bombs, and missiles. The Romans' ability to develop an iron-based weaponry, after bronze weapons, led to the defeat of Greece and the transfer of what was left of the Greek treasury to Rome. In modern times, aluminum, which was not isolated as a metal until 1827, has become exceedingly important as a critical metal for aircraft. Flying a plane made of iron would be difficult due to its weight, but lightweight aluminum made aerial warfare and long-range bombing possible. An aluminum plane delivered the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Many specialty metals are very important in war. For example, magnesium is used in flares to illuminate enemy positions. Without cobalt and vanadium, the jet engine would be impossible. Molybdenum, I'm just going to call it molyb-D because it's difficult to say. Molyb-D is a particularly useful metal employed in the equipment of war as well as in civilian uses, such as automobile steel sheet steel. It makes steel tough rather than brittle. Prior to World War I, the Germans, who were good metallurgists, had obtained and developed the world's largest molyb-D deposit at Climax, Colorado. It was called Mount Molly. These properties were, of course, confiscated during World War I, but the Germans had already taken quantities of molyb-D from Mount Molly before the outbreak of hostilities because they knew that molyb-D had made especially tough steel. They used this property of the metal in building the longest-range cannon ever constructed. It was nicknamed Big Bertha by the Allies and was used by the Germans to hurl shells into Paris from a distance of 75 miles. The Germans knew that the physical damage from this sort of bombardment from just one cannon would be minor, but they hoped the shelling would have a demoralizing effect on the French. It did not, and it was largely regarded as just a nuisance. Molyb-D remains a critical metal in many steel products, civilian and military. Without it, neither the ships and guns of the Navy nor the tanks and guns of the Army could be built. Oil and World War II. Oil may have been the decisive factor in ending World War II in Europe. Germany, with virtually no oil of its own, stockpiled some before the outbreak of hostilities. Subsequently, small amounts were obtained from the conquest of Poland, Austria, and Hungary. Romania, an Axis power, became Germany's major oil source. The Germans' main goal in the summer of 1942 was toward the huge Baku oil fields in southern Russia. When this was thwarted and the Romanian oil fields came under intense bombing by the Allies, Hitler's oil supplies began to fail. German motorized divisions toward the end of the war suffered markedly from lack of oil. When General George Patton was finally on the move across France with the Germans in full retreat, pipeline specialists from Texas and where else followed Patton's tanks and laid pipeline at a rate of up to 50 miles a day. And there was oil to fill these pipelines because during World War II, the Allies controlled 86% of the world's oil supply. Minor military actions and oil. In some less developed countries, where oil production is an important part of the economy, military factions frequently try to seize control of the oil facilities. In 1990, in the West African nation of Gabon, anti-government forces battled to gain control of the oil-producing center of Port Gentil. Gabon earns 80% of its income from oil, and whoever controls the oil production controls Gabon. The government forces won this skirmish. Water and war. The resource that all warring sides must have is water. Control of water supplies has been a tool in warfare in various ways. In the 6th century BC, the king of Syria seized water wells as part of his campaign against Arabia. The Inca conquered the desert coastal cities of Peru, such as Chan Chan, by cutting off their water supply. In feudal times, in Europe, castles and other fortresses under siege were vulnerable if they did not have water supplies within their walls. The enemy quickly determined if such was the case. Also, moats filled with water were part of the standard military protection of the day. In peacetime, control of water can be used as a form of economic warfare. More than 30 nations receive one-third or more of their water from outside their borders. In the case of Egypt, it is 97%, Hungary, 95%, Syria, 79%, and Iraq, 66%. With their surface waters chiefly under the control of other countries, these and 16 other nations, which obtain more than 50% of their surface water coming from outside their borders, are vulnerable to economic water warfare. Wars to obtain materials for war. Native Americans fought for possession of Obsidian Cliff in what is now Yellowstone National Park, probably one of the earliest battles fought for possession of mineral resources in the Western Hemisphere. Obsidian, a volcanic glass, makes razor-sharp arrowheads and is easy to shape. Those who had obsidian had a great advantage in both hunting and warfare. The Phoenicians, and later the Romans, fought for the possession of the tin mines in Cornwall in England after it was discovered that tin added to copper made bronze, a very hard alloy for weapons. German expansion. In the middle of the 19th century, Germany, once a collection of independent principalities, became one nation. It became clear to the Germans early on that their military operations were dependent on having raw materials for the conduct of warfare, and Germany was not self-sufficient in this regard. To obtain markets for finished industrial goods, and to obtain raw materials, chiefly minerals, for building armaments, and to supply their industrial complex, Germany began to look hungrily at adjacent territories. After the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, Germany annexed iron-rich Alsace-Lorraine. Unfortunately, they later found that the boundaries they set did not include the bulk of the iron deposits because of the geologic structure there. Germany captured the surface outcrop area, but the iron formation beds, with most of the iron ore, dipped westward into French territory. They apparently had a good military department, but a poor geology department. Germany fought the First World War in part, quote, to correct the error of 1871, unquote. After losing World War I, however, Germany had to give up this territory. The experience of World War I made both the Allies and the Central Powers, Germany and its allies, keenly aware of the need for minerals with which to conduct military operations. Immediate and extensive post-war mineral exploration and development programs for both foreign and domestic sources were started by Britain and France. Because these countries, especially Great Britain, still had extensive colonial holdings, there was a lot of territory to explore. Germany, in contrast, lost all its foreign possessions, which was one of the circumstances that precipitated World War II. As Germany prepared for World War II in the 1930s under Hitler, it had been unable to regain its colonies, so it began to annex its immediate neighbors who possessed useful resources. Austria was next door and had some small iron deposits. It was the first to be taken. Czechoslovakia contained famous mining districts with fairly large iron deposits and a variety of other metals. Czechoslovakia was taken next. With the early defeat of France in World War II, Germany regained control of the iron of Alsace-Lorraine. Global reach for minerals for war and peace. In the 1930s, the world witnessed a series of political and military moves globally to obtain raw materials, chiefly minerals and energy minerals. Growing industrialization, with its huge demand for raw materials, growing populations, and the desire for higher standards of living, were the immediate causes for the intensified search for resources. And in the background was the thought that should another war come, the materials must be available in order to survive and win it. Hitler covets Russia's resources. In World War II, once Germany had conquered France and driven the British back across the English Channel, Hitler turned east. In keeping with his belief in Lebensraum, the territory necessary for national existence and economic self-sufficiency, Hitler long held the view that only the Soviet Union had adequate land and minerals to take care of Germany's needs. After taking this region, Hitler said, quote, "We shall become the most self-supporting state in every respect in the world. Timber we will have in abundance, iron in unlimited quantities, and the greatest magnesium ore mines in the world, and oil we shall swim in it, unquote. Hitler turned his armies toward the Urals and the Ukraine. This region, along with the Donetsk Basin, contained extensive deposits of hematite, high-grade iron ore, excellent coking coal, and limestone, the three fundamental ingredients for steelmaking. Germany, Hitler thought, was now on its way to becoming a permanent world power, and his troops headed into the Soviet Union. But they were stopped at Stalingrad, and also at Leningrad, now once again called St. Petersburg, by heroic Russian defenders. The Russian winter also did its part. Oil to move implements of war. It was not only metals that became so clearly evident as important tools of warfare in World War I. Energy, chiefly in the form of that relative newcomer oil, was obviously going to be very significant. Some of the Allied ships bringing troops and supplies across the Atlantic from the United States to Europe were coal-fired, and some were oil-fired. The oil-powered ships were the better and faster vessels, greatly speeding delivery of both troops and equipment. Oil grew more important in warfare. Gasoline-powered tanks made their first appearance on the military scene in World War I. Airplanes, fueled by gasoline, primitive as they were, also came into the war in a limited fashion. For the first time in a major conflict, trucks replaced horse-drawn vehicles on a large scale. Recognizing this in the time between World War I and World War II, world military establishments began to give serious consideration to oil supplies. This is why Hitler coveted the oil fields of the southern Soviet Union. During World War I, the British Empire was still intact, and because the Allies controlled the sea lanes, raw materials for warfare were funneled in from all parts of the globe. As World War II began to loom as a possibility, Britain began strategic planning to ensure the proper flow of war materials. The United States made similar moves in 1939 when the U.S. Congress authorized funds to start an emergency stockpile of certain critical materials. Fortunately, Britain had access to many of its colonies and former possessions around the world. To a large extent, the British still controlled the sea lanes, so materials could be transported to the United States for processing into finished war material products, and also to Britain. Axis submarines made Allied shipping lanes much more hazardous. The situation then and during the rest of the war was summed up by Simon Strauss, an officer of the Metals Reserve Company, set up by the United States government just before World War II for this emergency. He stated, quote, "By the time Pearl Harbor broke out, all of Europe was under the domination of Hitler. Africa, Latin America, Australia, India, and even parts of China remained accessible to the U.S. The only competitive customer for mineral exports of these vast areas was the United Kingdom. An agency called the Combined Raw Materials Board was created by the U.S. and the U.K., and a coordinated buying program was launched. It was possible to fight World War II without an actual shortage of these critical materials. But the key was the fact that we retained access to Latin America, to all of Africa, to most of Asia, and to Australia. Had we been denied access to them, we would have been in trouble," unquote. The United States and Britain had access to large supplies of raw materials at the outset of World War II. This was not true for Japan. After it opened up to the rest of the world in the late 1800s, Japan resolved to become an empire, but it had very few natural resources. The nearest sufficient coal and iron deposits were in northern China, Manchuria. In the early 20th century, as an emerging Pacific power, Japan was increasingly in need of raw materials, particularly metals, coal, and oil, to equip its military. Japan invaded Manchuria for its deposits of iron and coal, and later Southeastern Asia for more raw materials. As the military seized such resources, it also gained materials for Japan's expanding civilian economy. Imperial Japan continued to expand its sphere of influence, innocently but deceptively named the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, largely through military action. The United States decided to invoke economic sanctions and in July of 1940 put an embargo on aviation fuel. But this was only a nuisance because other grades of gasoline could be cracked in Japanese refineries to produce aviation fuel. In September of 1940, the United States also embargoed scrap iron and steel shipments to Japan. Until then, the United States had been primarily concerned with matters in Europe. Asia was a secondary consideration. But when the Tripartite Pact was signed in September 1940 among Germany, Italy, and Japan, the shape of things to come began to emerge. With the signing of this pact, which said that each of the signatories would go to the aid of any other in time of war, the war that was already in progress in Europe since September 1, 1939, became fused with hostility in the Far East. This made the United States more anti-Japanese than before. Oil, chief concern of Japan. Records of meetings of the Japanese general staff clearly show the great concern about Japan's ability to survive a war with the resources it could have at hand at the start of the hostilities, and those which they hoped they could obtain immediately thereafter. Their major concern was oil. The United States and what was at that time the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, were the main suppliers of petroleum products to Japan. In July 1941, Japanese troops invaded southern Indochina. Britain, the Dutch East Indies, and the United States immediately embargoed all exports to Japan, including oil. The U.S. had been a major supplier. This reduced Japanese oil imports to about 10% of their previous volume. Immediately, Japan saw its storage tanks of oil as an hourglass gradually running down. Something had to be done, and something done very quickly. The Japanese general staff had to make some critical decisions. If Japan were to retain its position as a substantial power and maintain or improve its standard of living, it had to have access to raw materials. Without oil to fuel its merchant ships and its navy, this would be impossible. Japan would have to retreat to its own islands and remain a limited island-bound economy. At that time, the Japanese could not envision how they might develop into an industrial power. The hourglass of oil would last 2 years or less. Under conditions of intensive warfare, the oil might only last 6 months. Quote, an outline plan for carrying out the national policy of the empire, unquote, was drawn up and presented to a meeting of the Liaison Council on September 3, 1941. Faced with the alternatives of either beginning to withdraw or trying to move ahead, Japan decided to go to war with the United States if an agreement on oil could not be reached by October 15th. The date was later extended to November 25th and then November 30th. Japan's consumption of 12,000 tons of oil a day made oil the critical resource. If Japan had possessed adequate oil deposits within its own borders, the Japanese probably would not have gone to war with the United States. Japan's military was determined to seize the Dutch and British oil fields in Southeast Asia. To do this, they had to neutralize the United States fleet at Pearl Harbor. The attack was made on December 7th, 1941. Pearl Harbor, key to Japan's access to oil. Japanese Premier Tojo was the deciding influence on the decision to go to war. When the decision for war was made and December 7th came, Japan had two interrelated immediate objectives. The first was to destroy, or at least neutralize, the United States fleet in the Pacific. The second was to immediately move south and seize the oil fields of the Dutch East Indies. To do this, the United States fleet had to be sufficiently disabled that it could not protect the Dutch East Indies. This is what happened, and Japan did take the oil fields from the Dutch. Had the United States fleet been able to intercept the Japanese as they headed for the Dutch oil fields, the Pacific War probably would have been over in less than a year. Oil was the key, and Japan got its needed supplies, at least for a while. However, as the war continued and the United States was gradually able to cut off oil shipments to Japan, the matter of fuel became increasingly desperate for the Japanese. In the waning days of the war, Japan resorted to kamikaze, Japanese for divine wind, action. Suicide pilots would crash their planes into the ever closer ships of the U.S. Navy. This was in large part a matter of fuel efficiency, because the planes would be given just enough fuel to fly one way. They were not expected to return, and the pilots were told so. More than 4,000 Japanese young men were sacrificed this way. It was a desperate way of stretching fuel supplies. If a plane did hit a U.S. Navy ship, this would be a highly effective use of a small amount of fuel. Some planes did get through the anti-aircraft barrages and did considerable damage, but many more kamikaze planes were shot down. Finally, there was not enough oil to keep either the Japanese Navy or Air Force operational. Oil was Japan's Achilles heel in World War II. Wars simply to gain minerals for domestic use. Some wars are fought to enlarge an empire. Others, however, are fought simply to obtain mineral resources for domestic use, not political aggrandizement. Huns and salt. In the vicinity of Salzburg, Austria, there are ancient salt mines. Although these did not provide minerals for war, they provided a necessity for everyday life. As such, they were richly prized, and various clans of the Huns fought for their possession. Polish zinc, lead, and coal. Battles were fought by principalities of the time over the possession of the lead and zinc mines in Poland. As part of this settlement after World War II, Poland received some of the coal mines that were previously in Germany, in German territory. These coal mines are very important to the economy of Poland. Chile and nitrates. For a long time, there was a boundary question between Chile and Bolivia, but no one really cared about the exceedingly desolate northern Atacama Desert territory, Atacama Desert territory, until nitrates were discovered there in large quantity. These were the causes of the Nitrate War. Chile declared war on both Peru and Bolivia on April 5, 1879. The Chileans were victorious and obtained all of the Atacama Desert area by the Treaty of Ancon in 1883. The victory was of great economic value to Chile. From 1879 to 1889, the duty of nitrate exports alone reached more than $557 million, a very considerable sum in those days. The total value of nitrate exports in that period exceeded $1.4 billion. Nitrates have continued to be an important Chilean export, although the synthetic production of nitrates has reduced their value. Falkland Islands. The Falkland Islands are British possessions which geologically lie on a shallow shelf extending east from Argentina. On April 2, 1982, Argentina invaded the islands, which they called the Malvinas, and which they claim. On May 21st, British landed troops there, and on June 14th, Argentina surrendered. This British action was ostensibly to protect the sovereignty of Britain in the Falklands, as well as the self-determination of the island's residents who wished to remain British citizens. There were, however, other interests at stake, as the Falklands planned to offer offshore oil concessions for bid. Argentina, trying to do what it could not do militarily, offered to pay the Falklanders for citizenship by suggesting that they might pay up to $100,000 for each islander and up to $800,000 for each family if they voted to transfer sovereignty to Argentina. The Argentine foreign minister, I can't pronounce his name, Guido de Tella, stated that Argentina wanted the islands back for their intrinsic value, quote-unquote, not for their potential oil and gas reserves. As there were only about 2,100 islanders, at $100,000 per person, it would have cost $210 million for Argentina to buy the islands. A modest oil discovery would make that a very good investment. The Falklanders declined the offer, in good part due to their British loyalty. Since that time, oil exploration has continued, and a recent modest discovery has been made. Recent and current conflicts. With the recent large price increase of both oil and gas, and again, this was originally written in 1997, along with improved technology for deeper water drilling, the ownership of ocean waters, which was previously of little interest, is now being contested by adjacent countries. South China Sea. This is a region where oil was recently discovered, and the potential for future modest discoveries is good. The Spratly Islands dot the area and consist of about 100 coral reefs, tips of rocks, and 21 slightly submerged landforms. The emergent land is less than 2 square miles in total. Although these islands are located about 700 miles from China and only about 100 miles from the Philippines, China claims a huge swath of sea that overlaps and conflicts with the claims of other nations. Indeed, ownership in the strategic South China Sea is asserted in whole or in part by 9 nation states, mainly China, which claims at least 80%, and Vietnam. In 1988, China and Vietnam clashed violently over the Spratly Islands, and in 2012, China and the Philippines are in a tense naval standoff over their competing claims there as well. All 9 nations have set up little outposts on different rocks. Despite lacking clear ownership, both Vietnam and China have issued lease blocks to oil companies. In the meantime, oil-short China is building its navy and expanding its presence in the South China Sea. China needs much more oil as it plans to greatly enlarge its road network, increase motor vehicle production, and fuel for rapid industrialization and transport system. China / Japan. The boundary line between China and Japan in an area of open sea north of Taiwan was not important until a gas field was discovered in what China and Japan each claim as an exclusive economic zone. In 2005, a dispute over ownership arose that has not yet been settled. Both countries, especially Japan, are short of energy and ownership is likely to be strongly contested. In 2005, Japan began issuing drilling rights to Japanese companies in waters which China claimed. In late 2004, China began building drilling platforms near the disputed area, and Japan protested, fearing that Chinese development would deplete reserves from under the seabed in the Japanese-claimed zone. Thailand, Malaysia. Avoiding a dispute, Malaysia and Thailand entered into a joint agreement to develop the petroleum reserves in the Gulf of Thailand, which has worked out very well. Australia, East Timor, and the Timor Sea. The Timor Sea is the body of water that lies between northern Australia, East Timor, and Indonesia. East Timor became independent from Indonesia in 1999 after a brutal 24-year civil war. Australia now wants to renegotiate the treaty about the area it had with Indonesia. At stake are large petroleum resources, both oil and gas, with an estimated value of $30 billion, including the giant Greater Sunrise gas field. 60% of the residents of the tiny country of East Timor live on less than $2 a day, according to the World Bank, and revenue from the gas field would mean prosperity to East Timor. The field lies 95 miles south of Timor and 250 miles north of Australia. East Timor wanted to draw the line in the Timor Sea at the midway point, giving all of the major energy deposits, including Greater Sunrise Field, gas field, to East Timor. Although Australia helped East Timor achieve independence, it opposed this division. Oxfam Australia, an aid agency, reports that 1 in 10 East Timor children is likely to die before the age of 5. It also claims that Australia has received 10 times more from the Timor Sea oil and gas revenue than it has given East Timor in aid since 1999. The Australian Prime Minister said the report was, quote, emotional claptrap, unquote. East Timor wanted monthly meetings to get quick resolution of the dispute. Australia proposed 2 rounds a year. At that pace, a lot of oil would have been gone before the dispute was settled. A joint operational agreement was finally reached. Offshore Gulf of Guinea. Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea both claim territorial rights in the Zafiro oil field, which lies offshore between the two countries. The argument continues at this time, but the outcome might be imagined from the fact that Equatorial Guinea has a population of 500,000, and Nigeria, the most populous country in Africa, has a rapidly growing population of 137 million. Persian Gulf region, border disputes. Asher Saucer, a Middle Eastern expert at Tel Aviv University, states, quote, "The average Middle East border is only 70 years old, which is nothing in the context of the history of the region. In the eyes of many Arab countries, the region's borders remain fundamentally illegitimate, the artificial creation of foreign powers," unquote. The main reason for the border disputes that exist in the region today is the geography of its broad, relatively featureless desert areas that were occupied by nomadic tribes. In the past, there was little concern about boundaries, and national borders were rarely surveyed or even marked. Iraq's stated reason for the invasion of Kuwait in 1990 was a border dispute that crossed a very large oil field. More recently, United Arab Emirates officials say Iran is threatening military action over three islands in the Persian Gulf with probable oil potential. Because of a large number of border disputes in the Middle East, some believe it may take as much as 30 years to settle them all. But some countries are using joint development arrangements for natural resources to solve the problem. Whether this approach can resolve all the border disputes remains to be seen. Iran is actively building up its military strength, and all the Persian Gulf nations are increasing their spending on armaments. In 2007, the United States awarded $20 billion in armaments to the Gulf nations, except Iran. Peaceful settlements. The United States has an example of the peaceful settlement of a petroleum dispute. When oil was struck in the valley of the Red River between Texas and Oklahoma, the state's boundary was the center of the river. But the legal boundary was the Red River at the time Texas became a state in 1845, and the river has since changed course. The location question was finally settled by students of tree rings who determined where the channel ran in 1845. This was a simple issue to settle. Will disputes in progress now or in the future be settled peacefully, or will the increasing population pressures and needs for mineral and energy resources result in armed conflict? Many think that water may be the oil of the future relative to resource disputes. If so, nations like Egypt may face critical decisions about military action for its very survival, because nearly all of the water from its lifeblood, the Nile River, originates in other nations, which are now building dams. Up from just 28 million people in 1960, Egypt now has 82 million and is expected to have 111 million in 2025 and 124 million in 2050. Clearly, Egypt has some critical times ahead. Thirsty and hungry people become desperate people. Minerals in economic/political warfare. The first use of oil as a weapon in economic warfare occurred when Britain tried to maintain control of the Suez Canal in the 1950s. In support of Egypt, Saudi Arabia cut off oil supplies to Britain. At that time, the United States still had surplus oil producing capacity and simply opened the oil well valves wider to supply Britain's needs. The Arabs lost that economic skirmish, although the Suez Canal eventually went to Egypt. But in the 1970s, the Arabs and Iran realized that the United States was no longer self-sufficient in oil after the 1960s. As a result, the Persian Gulf nations were able to do two things. They could exert economic and political influence on the United States with regard to Israel, and they realized that they could begin to take control of their own economic destinies as industrial competitors with the Western world. Between 1940 and 1970, the price of Middle East crude oil ranged between $1.45 and $1.80 per barrel. This price was set in dollars not adjusted for inflation, which meant that the price of oil actually went down during that period. But realizing that the Western world, especially the United States, was no longer self-sufficient in oil, the Gulf countries and all of the oil and all the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC members, raised the price to more than $35 a barrel in less than 8 years. Colonel Gaddafi of Libya was the leader who broke the price barrier. When he seized control of Libya in 1969, he pressured one Libyan oil producer to make a 30 cents a barrel hike. Other Libyan producers soon did the same. Then other OPEC members followed, and the price spiral began. By 1965, when the United States could no longer supply its own oil needs and began to depend on imports, the Persian Gulf nations could start using oil as a weapon. When Arab-Israeli fighting began in 1973, the oil producers of the Middle East declared a selective boycott against consuming countries, especially the United States, because of its long-standing support of Israel. OPEC, using its newfound economic power, raised the price of oil from $3 a barrel in September 1973 to $11.65 a barrel in December, a nearly quadrupling of price. Henceforth, neither the oil companies nor the Western governments could control the price of oil. The best that could be done was to convince the oil-producing nations that their interests were intertwined with those of the West and that reasonable oil prices were vital to preserving their oil markets. For the most part, this logic has prevailed. Economic warfare by resource processing at source. There is, however, another kind of economic warfare developing, which might simply be called economic competition. This takes the form of industrial developments in some of the nations of the Persian Gulf. They include the large petrochemical complexes of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and the aluminum refining capacity of the UAE that compete directly with similar facilities in the West. This form of economic warfare will continue and probably intensify as the petroleum-producing capabilities of the world become more and more concentrated in the Middle East, and the nations that hold most of the petroleum continue to develop more petrochemical and refining industries to upgrade oil and gas to higher value end products. The oil-rich countries have been endowed by geology with the resources to be able to do this, and this guides their economic development. At the same time, it transfers jobs from the heretofore dominant petrochemical industry of the industrialized nations to the Middle East. Saudi Arabia is increasingly turning its attention to its large but relatively undeveloped natural gas deposits and has ambitious projects underway for a large petrochemical industry. In a sense, these events are not strictly warfare, but the evolution of a resource-producing nation into a more industrialized nation. It is free market competition. Abundant, cheap, domestic natural resources and a free enterprise system put the United States at the top of the world economies. Now, with the U.S. natural resources dwindling, others with substantial resources within their borders are having their turn. Earth resources continue to exact control over nations and individuals in an ever-changing economic scene. The United States and Rhodesia. There has been an interesting variation tried at times in using minerals in economic warfare. Rather than a producing country withholding a mineral resource, an importing country puts a ban on importing it to try to influence the producing country. The United States at one time embargoed the importation of chromium from Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, to influence the then Rhodesian government with respect to its apartheid racial policies. But the United States still needed chromium, and the only other substantial supplier was the USSR. The Soviets promptly tripled the price of the chrome they sold the United States. What they could not supply themselves, they brought from Rhodesia, and also tripled the price of the chrome when it was resold to the United States. The United States finally gave up the embargo. USSR and Lithuania. In the final days of the former Soviet Union, the Baltic republics, and particularly Lithuania, showed intentions of wanting to break away. Fearing the precedent this might create, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev threatened to cut off all energy supplies to Lithuania in April of 1990. Almost all of Lithuania's coal, oil, and gas came from what is now Russia. This was blatant economic warfare. It imposed a hardship which the Lithuanians endured without shaking their resolve to leave the Soviet Union. After the Soviet Union collapsed, supplies were restored because Russia needed the income. Minerals to finance internal struggles. Unfortunately, mineral resources within a country sometimes have to be used to finance insurgent groups, and in some cases, civil wars. Colombia has an ongoing drug war. It's the world's largest producer of cocaine, 90% of which goes to the United States. Oil accounts for a third of Colombia's export earnings. Drug-running rebels have tried to cut the government's oil income. Since 1986, they have attacked the country's major pipelines more than 900 times. In 2001, they put a pipeline out of operation for 266 days, which cost the government nearly $600 million in lost revenue. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, formerly Zaire, major conflicts between rival groups over very rich deposits of cobalt, tin, copper, molybdenum, and diamonds have resulted in the killing and displacement of several million people. This has given rise to the evocative term blood diamonds, which have also helped spark and sustain cruel insurgencies in Angola, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and the Ivory Coast. The future. Economic warfare for Earth's energy and metals clearly exists in various forms today. It will continue and may even intensify as resources become scarcer in the face of growing populations and rising industrial demand around the world, especially as less developed nations like China become ever more industrialized. China today is running short of many raw materials, including oil, to support its rapid industrialization. It is bidding against all other industrial nations for an increasing share of the world's remaining oil and other mineral supplies. Economic warfare using energy and mineral resources as weapons can only be employed by those who possess these resources in some significant quantity. There are currently two places where this situation exists. One is the Persian Gulf region, and the other is Russia, which includes about 80% of the former Soviet Union with its vast mineral wealth. The Persian Gulf. As oil in the other regions is depleted and more of the world's remaining oil resources become concentrated in the Gulf area, the opportunity for effective economic warfare using these resources increases. However, Gulf nations are not united. Saudi Arabia, with the largest oil resources in the region and with excess production capacity, has occasionally gone it alone to determine oil export policy. Whether all the Gulf nations could present a solid front in the future for economic warfare is an open question. Their greatest unifying element is that they are all Muslim countries. The increasing control of the world's oil resources by the Gulf nations will correspondingly enhance their ability to engage in economic warfare. However, their need to export oil on a continuing basis to supply their growing populations is a strong moderating element. The demand of an increasing population may preclude any reduction or cutoff in oil supplies, except from those imposed by the eventual natural geological limits of oil production. Editor's note, his point about all of the Gulf regions being Muslim doesn't mention the fact that there are at least two major types of Islam that are often at war with each other. Russia, mineral resource giant. This largest country in terms of area in the world saw two political upheavals in the 20th century. First was the rise of communism and the Soviet state following the fall of Nicholas II, the Tsar of Russia, during World War I. Second was the disintegration of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, with Russia as the remaining dominant unit in a rather uncertain political and economic condition. At this time, its leadership seems to be at least moderately constructive. But one thing is certain. Russia has huge natural resources within its borders that can be used in economic warfare. In the past few years, Russia's oil production has been built up with significant foreign expertise, a trend for a constructive, cooperative future. Recently, however, there has been a renationalization of the Russian petroleum industry, reversing a trend toward a more open economic system that emerged with the breakup of the Soviet Union. There is some international uneasiness about this. Russia has the world's largest deposits of natural gas, very large coal deposits, extensive and still mostly underdeveloped copper resources, and large deposits of virtually all other important minerals. But it has been difficult to develop this wealth because of limited access. To correct this, the Soviets decided years ago to build another railroad through Siberia to augment the heavily overloaded original Trans-Siberian line. This new rail line, called the Baikal-Amur Magistral, the BAM, was completed and has opened up a mineral-rich region that will allow Russia to export a variety of important resources. As a result, Russia will be in a position to influence world mineral markets well into the future. Slow to develop, but much left. Russia has been slow in developing its great natural resources, reducing the standard of living of its citizens. But this delayed development also means that Russia still has untapped resources. In contrast, the United States developed its resources early and rapidly, propelling the United States to the top of the world's living standards in record time. But in the process, the richest U.S. energy, mineral, and mineral resources have been exhausted. Russia still has most of its resources undeveloped, and this could be a factor in future economic warfare. Whether or not the new regime in Russia will pursue economic warfare against the Western democracies, only time will tell. The record of the USSR in the Cold War, which followed World War II and continued until the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, was clearly one of economic warfare against the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO allies, and particularly the United States. Currently, Russia seems inclined to join the rest of the world in a mutually constructive fashion. It is a major oil and gas exporter, earning hard currency. To some extent, at least, the present Russian administration is turning its attention to the welfare of its citizens, exploiting its mineral wealth, and a broad middle class is emerging. Russian gas equals economic and political strength. Russia, with the world's largest gas reserves, lies adjacent to the Western European industrialized countries, which must increasingly import substantial energy supplies. Although the apparent immediate intention of Russia is simply to sell natural gas to obtain foreign exchange, a long-term result could be that Western Europe becomes more and more dependent on Russia for energy supplies and vulnerable to Russian influence. Over the longer term, Russia will be in an increasingly strong position in the European energy supply situation and can exert a corresponding influence on this region. Sweden and Russian energy. Sweden has voted to eventually phase out all existing nuclear plants and not to build any new ones. Since Sweden has no coal or oil and only a modest amount of hydropower, where its future energy supplies will come from is a problem which seems to have been ignored. Some people in Sweden envision a solar biomass wind economy. Whether these combined energy resources, dispersed and intermittent, can replace steady, predictable, and high-quality nuclear power at the scale required is questionable. For the immediate future, Sweden has begun talks with Russia about obtaining Russian oil and gas supplies. What the ultimate result of its energy policy will be, only time will tell, but it is likely to make Sweden somewhat economically vulnerable to Russia. Finland and Russian gas. Finland already gets some of its gas from Russia through a pipeline in southeast Finland completed in 1974. The pipeline network has been extended into the Helsinki and Tampere districts. Tampere, however that's pronounced. Most of the oil Finland uses comes from Russia. Finland also imports substantial amounts of Russian coal. Germany and Russian resources. 15% of Germany's energy demand is met by natural gas, and most of this is imported. Russia is its most important supplier. Eventually, or inevitably, Russian gas will be increasingly important to its one-time adversary, Germany. Germany also imports 95% of its oil, about 6% of which now comes from Russia. In the wake of the 2011 disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan, and Germany's subsequent decision to phase out nuclear power, Germany may become even more dependent on natural gas imports from Russia. Turkey. Turkey has long been a thorn in the side of Russia because it controls shipping and naval access to the warm waters of the Mediterranean through the Dardanelles. The border between the two countries has been a tense one at times. But the Russians have penetrated energy-short Turkey with natural gas lines, and Russian gas now heats homes and fuel factories in the Turkish capital, Ankara. Poland dependent on Russia. Poland is an example of a country which has, in effect, already lost the battle of economic warfare. Nominally, it has an independent country, but it depends on Russia for very basic needs. Russia can bring Poland to an economic standstill merely by cutting off its oil supply. Poland also depends on Russia for large supplies of fertilizer made from natural gas and for magnesium and nickel. However, by using the new technology of shale hydrofracking for gas, Poland may achieve some degree of independence from Russia for its gas supply. The Baltic Basin offers a promising region for gas exploration. Russian need for foreign exchange. Russia has been obtaining about 60% of its hard currency from the sale of oil and gas. Without this income, Russia would have a difficult time supplying its military with needed technological equipment, such as state-of-the-art computers. Oil and gas earnings also buy grain, something in chronic short supply in Russia. Grain bolsters the civilian economy, but grain also feeds Russia's large standing armies. Russia in the future. It is inevitable that Russia, with its generous geological endowment of energy and mineral resources, is geodestined to play an important role in the future of many nations. This may bring the new Russia more fully into the world economy with trade in vital raw materials. Will the Russia of the future prove to be a friendly neighbor to the Western nations, or will it return to its political isolation and antagonism toward the West, using its huge coal, gas, and mineral resources as weapons? The Cold War was a time when the Soviet Union was active in economic warfare against the NATO allies in many regions. That activity appears to have ceased, or at least eased, and now Russia shows a somewhat friendlier attitude toward the West. The need for Western technology may bring the new Russia more fully into a world economy. Russia is the most natural resource self-sufficient nation in the world, and the least vulnerable to cut off from a wide variety of mineral and energy mineral resources. It is in a better position to avoid conflict over mineral resources than the rest of the world. The reality of Russia's nearly complete self-sufficiency in minerals and energy minerals, compared with other industrial nations, will be important in future world affairs. With the largest and broadest energy and mineral resource base of any nation, Russia could do very well economically. Oil, the United States, China, and Japan. In order, these are the three largest oil-consuming nations in the world, and their economies are vitally dependent on oil at the present time. It is doubtful that alternative energy sources can arrive in quantity or in time to replace diminishing quantities of oil. The result will be an intensified scramble for the remaining world oil reserves, in competition, of course, with all economies that use oil. The principal sources of the remaining oil will be the Persian Gulf countries, particularly Saudi Arabia and Russia, although Russian oil supplies will run out before the Persian Gulf nation supplies do. How this war for oil resources will be conducted is not entirely clear, but to some degree it's already in progress. All three countries are engaged in a worldwide search for oil, both through their oil companies and also through investments in various operations in oil regions, pipelines, refineries, and others. In the iron mining regions of northern Minnesota, for example, Chinese investment has reopened a mine and built a pelletizing plant to upgrade the low-grade taconite iron ore, only 30% iron. They are shipping the product to China. This trend will continue, and the outcome is uncertain as we create a globalized economy. China is the 800-pound gorilla on the scene. It is becoming an industrial giant. The steep increases in the prices of steel, copper, aluminum, and especially oil are due in considerable part to China's growing resource demands. In regards to oil, China is moving from bicycles to motorized wheels. Several major auto firms have established factories in China, recognizing it as a prime market for future growth. China's resource demands are also mirrored in Southeast Asia and India. A new world economy is emerging, different from the 20th century. Things change. The cheap labor weapon. Economic warfare over the past two decades is also seen taking place in the area of labor costs. Low-wage countries, aided by free trade agreements, have been able to transfer the manufacture of many products from industrialized countries, particularly the United States, to their own shores. This has created huge trade imbalances. China, in particular, has a large positive trade balance with the rest of the world, especially the United States. Armed with U.S. dollars and other foreign currencies, China, and to a lesser extent India, have embarked on a worldwide buying spree to obtain a variety of raw materials. Particular investment targets are Canada for its metal resources, Chile for its metals, Venezuela for its oil, and Australia for its metals, natural gas, and coal. This investment strategy is intensifying, particularly by China, as it also reaches into Africa for both metals and oil. One result of low-wage competition for the United States has been a large decline in its manufacturing base. The increasing deficit in international balance of payments threatens the stability of the dollar. Dollars exported to pay for things previously produced domestically come back to compete with the United States in the form of buying power of the cheap labor countries who use the dollar to bid against the United States for natural resources worldwide. Thanks to its trade surpluses, China has had a great inflow of dollars to use for worldwide resource acquisition. The Wall Street Journal, in August of 2005, raised this question: do economic threats or military threats pose a bigger challenge to the United States? War or reason? Struggles for resources, especially oil, will continue as population pressures grow and resources become increasingly scarce. Will this worldwide increased demand for energy and minerals, compounded by the current exponential growth in population, be resolved by reason? Or will the struggle result in war and anarchy, as suggested in the very thought-provoking book by Robert Kaplan, The Coming Anarchy, published in 2000? Around the world, reason and goodwill are in shorter supply than they should be. By myriad adjustments in lifestyles and economics, the world must adjust to the new realities of resource availability. It is clear that the future cannot supply a continually growing population with resources as we use them now. But we seem to be trying to do just that. As a result, there is a race for resources beyond the scope of anything ever seen before. As Clare, in 2001, has noted in his book Resource Wars, there is a new geography of conflict. It is truly global.